Om Namah Shivaya. Dear listeners of Shaivam.org, the next program is Spiritual Discourse. In this, you are about to listen Kawai Hindu Lectures. The titles are Hinduism Comprehensive, Internalizing Worship, Thirukkural Backbeating, presented by Sri Shivaya Bodhinatha Velayatha Swami. Thank you. Om Namah Shivaya.
This is from Gurudeva's lesson of the day. Hinduism is the most dynamic religion on the planet, the most comprehensive and comprehending. The Hindu is completely filled with his religion all of the time. It is a religion of love. Common bonds uniting all Hindus into a singular spiritual body are the laws of karma and dharma, the belief in reincarnation, all-pervasive divinity, the ageless traditions, and our gods. Our religion is a religion of closeness, one to another, because of the common bond of loving the same gods. All Hindu people are a one family, for we cannot separate one god too far from another. Each in its heavenly realm is also of a one family, a divine hierarchy which governs and has governed the Hindu religion from time immemorial and will govern Sanatana Dharma on into the infinite. So that's a useful word there in the first sentence. Hinduism is comprehensive. Covers a lot of different areas of life, and sometimes instead of saying comprehensive, we say complex. And sometimes that turns into a question, you know, why is Hinduism such a complex religion? Why can't it be simpler? Well, one of the good answers is, well, if it was simpler, then it would leave certain people out. Because the simpler you get, the narrower the teachings are, and you'll drop people off. They won't be able to relate to what you're teaching. It'll be too simple or too advanced. So because Hinduism is comprehensive, it has a place for everyone. Though sometimes that's called complexity, but comprehensive is a better word. There was a Swami we met, I guess it was his teacher we met in South India. We heard his tape recording and he was explaining why Hinduism is such a complicated religion, and that was his answer. He said, well, because it has a place for everyone. Doesn't leave anyone out. Hinduism was never created, never founded as a religion. Therefore, it can never end. Till the Persians attached the name Hindu to those people living east of the river Indus, and the name Hinduism later evolved to describe their religious practices, this ancient faith bore a different title, the Sanatana Dharma, the eternal truth. The understanding was that within every man, the germ or cell of his total affinity with God exists as the perennial inspiration of his spiritual quest and wellspring of all revelation. This enduring sense of an ever-present truth that is God within man is the essence of the Sanatana Dharma. Such an inherent reality wells up lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, unfolding the innate perfection of the soul as man comes more fully into the awakened state of seeing his total and complete oneness with God. Well, that's, of course, the most mystical definition or look at Hinduism. That it's Sanatana, it's eternal, and it's within us, it's not outside. We don't have to look around and find a book to find this truth. The truth is inside the soul. So Gurudeva explains it quite nicely. Wells up lifetime after lifetime. Well, why does it well up? Well, it wells up when the soul reaches a certain maturity. Those of you who have raised a number of children, I'm sure have had the experience that everything's fine with the toys, and then all of a sudden, the child outgrows the toy. It seems a childish toy, too old. So it's the way it happens. You grow up, and then you need a higher truth. So in the same sense, the soul grows up and gets tired of just experiencing that which is outside of it and eventually wants something profounder. So then there's that search that naturally clicks in. So the search is inherent in the soul itself. It's the idea. When the soul reaches a certain maturity, it starts turning within and saying, well, let's see. The outside world isn't quite what I thought it was. Maybe there's something more to life. And that's the search that Gurudev was talking about. Such an inherent reality wells up lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, unfolding the innate perfection of the soul as man comes more fully into the awakened state of seeing his total and complete oneness with God. So I was reading this on the web, and the web, you know how the web is. You find one thing and then want to go find something else, right? It's terrible. So I said, perennial, okay, perennial philosophy reminded me of Aldous Huxley's book called Perennial Philosophy. So there it was on Google Books. So Google Books is terrible. You can't print Google Books, you know. So I had to take a photograph. What's the name of it? Grab. I had to use Grab and photograph the page, save the page, then print the page as a saved page. So it makes you work hard. And the type is just terrible. You know? They just really produce a product that makes you want to use another product. So it was interesting. I just grabbed looked at the first two pages to remind myself what it was about. I remember reading it years ago. So he starts out in chapter 1. Studying the perennial philosophy, we can begin either at the bottom with practice and morality, or at the top with consideration of metaphysical truths, or finally in the middle, at the focal point where mind and matter, action and thought have their meeting place in human psychology. So what a beautiful statement, but I related it more to the statement itself. It describes Gurudeva's teachings. And again, we were looking at the word comprehensive. So Gurudeva doesn't present just one of these three viewpoints, which some philosophers or religious teachers, they grab onto just one or maybe two, but not all three. So Gurudeva, in the trilogy in particular, details all three aspects of the approach. So starts out very simply. We have our yamas and niyamas, what's right and wrong, the basic principles of life, don't get angry, so forth. You know, we have all the practical matters. Then, as he points out here, where mind and matter meet is the middle point. So that is understanding the mind, understanding the subconscious mind, using affirmations, clearing out the mind through Vasana Daha Tantra, writing down the past and burning it up. We have all these techniques to work with and mold the contents of the mind and control the mind. And then we have the high metaphysical truths that man is God and profound meditations that Gurudeva has mapped out in the Shum language. So we have all three areas within Gurudeva's teaching. So I thought that was nice to see that reflected in his way of looking at the great teachers of the world, religious teachers. He gives an example of Buddha. He says, the lower gate is that preferred by strictly practical teachers, men who, like Buddha, have no use for speculation and whose primary concern is to put out in men's hearts the hideous fires of greed, resentment, and infatuation. Nicely said. He goes on to explain the search to realize oneself. Based upon the direct experience of those who have fulfilled the necessary conditions of such knowledge, This teaching is expressed most succinctly in the Sanskrit formula Tattvamasi, that art thou. The Atman or eminent eternal self is one with Brahman, the absolute principle of all existence. And the last end of every human being is to discover the fact for himself, to find out who he really is. So nicely said. So that's the idea there, that Hinduism is sanatana, it's eternal. We don't have to look for a scripture to find these truths. They're inside of us, always been there. And eventually every person comes to the point in life where the soul starts getting interested in that aspect of life. It's just a natural process. Not everyone does it in the same lifetime. Otherwise, we'd put Madison Avenue out of business. We wouldn't buy anything anymore. Don't want to do that. They have to make a living, too. Thank you very much.
Good morning. This is from our emerging Reshiva lesson for today. Unconditional surrender. What do we mean by internalizing worship? In external worship, we are trying to see God and communicate with God with our two eyes and our physical nerve system. We enjoy his darshan and feel his shakti. In deep meditation, the external worship is deliberately internalized, and we are trying to see God with our third eye and feel God's all-pervasiveness through our psychic nerve system. Externalizing bhakti is really much easier than internalizing it, but once the externalized bhakti is perfected, it will be easy and natural to internalize bhakti right along. When this is accomplished, the most rigorous hurdles and time-consuming practices of yoga, which often lead the person onto Anava Marga, will have been sidestepped. So that's our particular tradition, Sarvasiddhanta. We have the temple before we have meditation. We learn to experience God in the temple before we experience God inside ourselves. And as Gurudev is pointing out, the first step leads naturally into the second. Once the externalized bhakti is perfected, it will be easy and natural to internalize bhakti right along. Versus hard. So hard is doing lots of pranayamas and some techniques to get the kundalini activated. Those are the rigorous hurdles and time-consuming practices. So we can skip all of that if we do well in our temple worship first. In other words, we're naturally in the right mood already. We don't have to work hard to get our energies in the right place. The temple worship has already put them there. So Gurudev is even more specific in the next paragraph. He says, to internalize worship, after the puja is over, sit before the deity and draw into yourself all the pranas you feel around your body. That's the first step. Then draw those energies up the spine into the head. Step two. This is done with the mind and with the breath. It is very easy to do. It is especially easy when one is at the end of a major karmic cycle. The bhakti of uncompromising surrender, prapati, to the god during a temple puja awakens the amrita. The amrita is the sweet essence from the Sarasvara chakra. It is the binding yoke to the divine. Bind yourself in the lotus posture after temple worship and simply internalize all the feelings that you had for the god during the worship. That's all there is to it. The yogi yoked within enjoys the amrita that flows from the cranium throughout his body. Devotees who want to awaken the higher chakras and sustain that awakening on the safe path will throw themselves into becoming uncompromising bhaktas. Then all the gods of all three worlds will open their hearts and shower blessings upon them. Oh, that's a nice specific description there Gurudeva gives us. After the puja, sit before the deity and draw into yourself all the pranas you feel around you, meaning your energy that's going out. It's not energy that's not you. It's your energy that's going outward. That's what it means, pranas. Then draw those energies up the spine into the head. This is done with the mind and with the breath. So different individuals have different aptitudes for meditation. Some find it easy all the time. Some find it easy only some of the time. Others find it difficult all the time. So, why that is, maybe it's past life practice. But this is a good technique here. In other words, particularly if we feel our meditation isn't that great all the time, then this particular practice can help us go within more easily, because we're taking advantage of what's happened during the puja and internalizing it before it dissipates. It will dissipate if we don't internalize it soon after the puja. So if we do it right afterwards, then it's a way of going within, and then eventually we don't need the puja to catalyze us. We can do the same thing just as effectively without the puja. We're getting ready to fly off again. Busy time of year here. Someday we'll get the schedule so it doesn't do this. But every August, September, it gets too many events. So what, we're leaving Sun 5, is it? Sun 5? For Malaysia, Singapore, we're doing an interesting presentations. Thinking the one for Singapore, I was thinking they wanted something on Saivism, which I had about half ready, maybe an hour and a half, 2 hour presentation. And then they said, no, we want something on Tirukkural, and it should be 4 hours long. They told me this 2 months ago. So I didn't want to say no, but definitely, I think right now it has 525 slides in it. It's a bit big. But it's interesting, and I think you all might enjoy it, so we'll have to find a time we can show it. It's going through the first section, which is on virtue, first 38 chapters, plus a few, three or four from subsequent sections. And presenting it in terms of different concepts or themes that are in the Tirukkural. We're not going it through a single verse at a time, which would be way too tedious. So I'll just give you the first theme, since it's on my mind. The first theme is, you asked the question, what are the four components or conditions we need on earth for spiritual life to exist? So everyone will think and then speak up and so forth. And then we go through the four chapters of the introduction, which basically give us what Tiruvallavar thinks are the four most important things. That's why he put them in the introduction. Well, first one, of course, God. That could be a normal guess. First chapter is in praise of God. So we need the worship of God in order to make spiritual progress. Second one is the importance of rain. So we need rain so we can grow food. And rain also, in our modern thinking, I mean, rain in South India, because it's a monsoon, takes on a big importance, because it only rains a couple of months of the year, and it doesn't rain the rest of the year in India. So the monsoon in Tamil Nadu is the one that starts in October, middle of October through the middle of December, roughly, is the rainy season. So if the rain doesn't come during those 2 months, then there's not enough water for agriculture and other uses. But in our modern world, you know, I look at it as ecology, you know, not just rain. You know, the planet has to work right. And they didn't have global warming back then to worry about. So the planet has to be functioning right, including rain. The third one is the one that is going to surprise everyone unless they know the Tirukkural. That's called the greatness of renunciates. Well, one of the four points that Tiruvallavar thinks is important is having renunciates around. So I have a little story of, you know, modern Hindu families sitting around the table, and one says, "Oh, my son has a master's degree in information technology." And the next one says, "You know, my daughter is a plastic surgeon." And the third one says, "Oh, my son's a renunciate." In other words, it doesn't have the social status it used to. Doesn't have the importance it used to. It's not understood, and it's one of the reasons Gurudeva points out nicely in the introduction that renunciates are the natural ministers, those who can teach. And Hinduism is short on qualified teachers, unless you're a member of Swami Narayan. They have 700, 800 qualified teachers, but everybody else is a bit short. So that's there. That's the third requirement. Then the fourth one is dharma, asserting virtue's strength. So dharma, the guidelines of what to do, what practices should we follow, what are our duties in life to make spiritual advancement. So those are the four components that are needed on earth for spiritual life. So we'll see how that works. But see how close they come to guessing them. So we'll find a way of fitting it in here. Total presentation is supposed to take about 3.5 hours with a half an hour tea break. So figure out a way to present it here. Okay, have a wonderful phase. Good morning. Nice to be back. One of our events was in Singapore. We presented the Tirukkural for about 3.5 hour presentation with a tea break in the middle. Long presentation. Very interesting group. The Hindu Center sponsored the event, Hindu Center of Singapore, and they wanted a small group of 50, so they limited the group to 50 and charged a small fee. So we were in a room that just held about 55 people. So it was a nice compact group, and it was interesting. You know, when you get, made me realize when you have people spread out in a larger place, it's harder to get interaction going with them. Whereas when you're in a smaller space, it works better. So we had a very interactive time, lots of laughter. Told more jokes than usual, I guess. So the Tirukkural presentation, I mentioned, I think, before I left, the idea of the four introductory chapters was the first part, and then after that, we pulled two themes out of the householder chapters on virtue. There's two dominant themes that are there. The first is expressing love in the home, and the second is acts of charity, particularly charity expressed through hospitality and giving to the poor was what he focuses on. So to show how it relates to Gurudeva's teachings, we related the expressing love to the positive discipline approach and gave some of the ideas there. And I think many of those present were surprised that the positive discipline approach to raising children fits right into the Tirukkural. They hadn't really thought about that before. But it's very strong, you know, about expressing love, not just to the family, but supposed to express affection to all. That's the goal. And he even has one that says, it must be to be united again with love that the soul unites with the body. Something like that, I think, is the verse. So it's definitely a strong theme. So we went through that, and then we went through, we grouped the rest of the material into what I called self-control, because a lot of the chapters are about controlling anger, controlling violence, not being envious, and so forth. All of that's there. So to give it structure, because it's hard to organize it in a way that flows smoothly, we categorize the chapters according to the yama. So we took the 10 yamas and then put one or more chapters into each yama and then presented them in that way, and that seemed to work out very well. The theme of it all was the relevance of, the topic was called Tirukkural Relevance to the Modern Day. It's very interesting. Gurudeva focuses right on that very point in the introduction. They chose the topic, and I'm sure they didn't know it was in Gurudeva's introduction. But Gurudeva spends a couple of pages explaining why the Tirukkural is relevant, and it's basically that human nature hasn't changed. A lot has changed in 2,000 years. You know, how we get around. We used to get around in walking and bullock carts 2,000 years ago, and now we use airplanes, fast-going cars. We used to communicate in a very simple way. Not that much communication took place. Now we have the internet and other things that link us in a very different way than we were 2,000 years ago. So our technology has drastically changed, but our human nature hasn't. We still have the same ambitions and the same weaknesses, same problems to overcome, same spiritual ambitions to achieve. So in that sense, it shows why the Tirukkural is quite relevant, because though technology has changed, mankind hasn't. So one of the faults that Tiruvallavar explains quite nicely. I like the way he puts it. He throws some humor in, and is backbiting, which is chapter 18, avoidance of backbiting. So part of my commentary in the keynote goes like this. It says, finding faults in others and sharing this finding faults in others and sharing this finding with others is a hobby many enjoy. Have you noticed that it is so much easier to look for faults in others and complain about them than to see the same faults in yourself and change them? That's the point, of course, right? It is a lot easier. I can vouch for that. Of course, on the spiritual path, this approach entirely misses the point. The goal is to focus on our own improvement and not be concerned about the progress or faults of others. So 2 Corinthians, 3 verses. First one strikes me as being humorous. If men are disposed to spread the faults of friends, what deadly harm might they do to strangers? Oh, I think that's great. Then there's some logic for refraining. As you'll recall, I think I explained it to you of all of our... gives three rationale for doing something. This is the most common one. He uses reason. He reasons you into understanding the benefits of doing it or the benefits of not doing it. And then the other two methods he uses are, it's just the right thing to do. This is what high-minded people do. He uses that one sometimes. And then the third one is, he uses a scare tactic. He says, you're going to suffer a long time if you do that. Those who are motivated by fear. So he gets those who are motivated by fear, those who are motivated by reason, and those who are motivated by high-minded thinking. He addresses all three groups. So this one is the logical approach. If a man spreads tales of others' faults, his own worst faults will be exposed and spread. That's a very good reason to refrain from backbiting. You don't want your own worst faults out there. And then, this is again humorous. If men perceive their own faults as they do the faults of others, could misfortune ever come to them? Meaning, you know, we're so picky in the faults of others, if we were that aware of our own tendencies, we couldn't help but succeed. But we tend to focus that perceptiveness on someone else rather than ourselves. So Gurudeva has a lot of material on backbiting and in the trilogy. And one of the reasons, an interesting reason that Gurudeva points out that we normally wouldn't think about, that we backbite is we have a strong reaction to qualities in another person. And, of course, if we have a strong reaction to qualities that are in another person, not just a mild reaction, but a strong reaction, it means that qualities are in us, but we aren't seeing them. They're hidden or repressed. That's the only reason we react strongly to qualities in another person. Otherwise, we just say, oh, that's the way he is, or that's the way she is. But if we strongly react, we just really get irked by something in someone else, it means it's in us and we're hiding it from ourselves. It's repressed. So Gurudev explains, a repression is a desire that is only found when an emotional reaction... let me start at the beginning. So this is cognizant ability, which stretches the mind, but we'll give it a try here. This is aphorism 8. Some say they meditate while working or riding on the bus. This is a wrong concept of the word, a sign of emotional desire for attention. For meditation only comes when the subconscious mind has been released of all repressions. A repression is a desire that is only found when an emotional reaction takes place in the conscious and subconscious mind, such as dislikes, hates, or fears. Then the key point. For we only react to that in others of what is locked in a corner of our own subconscious mind in the form of an experience we have yet to go through, either physically or mentally. So that's the reason we react strongly. Gurudeva continues, he says, the subconscious mind analyzes a problem two ways. First, from the plane of reason. Second, from the plane of intuition. Intuition works through, but it does not use the process of reason. Intuition is more direct than reason and far more accurate. Conscious mind builds us into a personality, desirable or undesirable. We can readily change this personality by releasing hidden repressions. Repressions are unfulfilled, suppressed desires, like those that lurk in the corners of the mind and pop out at psychological moments until they are suppressed again by the conscious mind. This is the problem we face before we can unlock the superconscious realm of the mind. This problem can be totally impossible, or it can be made easy, depending upon the approach. Meaning if we use our intuition, it's easy. That's what Gurudeva means there. It is a well-known fact that when the mind releases tendencies that have long been suppressed, reaction occurs. This reaction is what we must anticipate and take into consideration at all times. It is the cause of new repressions if allowed to dominate the consciousness. And then I say, for more details, see aphorism 8. It keeps going, gives examples and everything. But it's an interesting reason that we may be backbiting is we're reacting to something and someone and not realizing that that quality is in ourselves. Either in terms of a personality trait in ourselves or personality trait from someone else, such as a parent, that we haven't fully accepted or resolved. We're still reacting to it. So when we see that quality in someone else, we react to it because it's in our own mind in an unresolved way. So that's the key is, you know, if you have a strong reaction to someone else, think twice. You know, what is in me that I see in them that I haven't fully understood? Wonderful week. Om Namah Shivaya.